Chapter 3, Becoming a Professor. Quote by Lou Lieberman, my grandfather. You're not going to reach every student. If you have two or three exceptional students, you should be proud. Photo description, Lauren tactile signing with a camper.
Go, Dana, you can do it!
Everyone in the rock gym was cheering for the boy up high on the wall. Dana had cerebral palsy and used an electric wheelchair. But with some modifications and physical assistance, he did everything the others at summer camp did. For tennis, we held the racket to his hand with Velcro while he received physical support from one of his many friends. He swam with flotation devices and he played volleyball, again with some physical support from a friend, by catching and throwing the ball close to the net. I had been asked by one of my OSU professors, Dr. Jeff McCubbin, to run this two-week summer sports camp. I had so treasured my own times at camp as a child that I jumped at the chance to bring the experience to others. The children and their parents loved the idea. Participating in the camp were children with cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, intellectual disabilities, and autism. We had an equal number of siblings and peers, all about the same ages as the campers with disabilities. Most knew each other from schools in the surrounding small city of Corvallis. On campus, I had reserved the pool and track, as well as the courts for tennis, basketball, and volleyball. But the biggest attraction was the climbing wall, with colorful rocks at various pitches to challenge the most avid climber. The rocks and the upbeat music put everyone in a good mood in the rock gym. On this day, I had decided to put the modified harness on Dana, who had cerebral palsy and used a wheelchair, one that supported his whole body. The man belaying, Tom, made sure to secure all of Dana's weight. Dana could hold onto the rocks, but he could not support his full body weight. I explained to him which rocks to grab and where he could rest his feet. Tom pulled Dana higher and higher as Dana grabbed the next rocks. The rest of the campers waiting in line began to look up and shout.
Wow, look at Dana, they chanted. Dana, Dana, Dana.
Dana got so excited that he tensed up, making it more difficult to reach for each rock. But with more encouraging shouts from others, he slowly pulled himself up. He eventually made it to the top, receiving a chorus of, Dana, you rock! The whole gym was bursting with pride. For the rest of the camp, I heard kids talking about the day Dana made it to the top and taught us all something about overcoming obstacles. I didn't know it then, but the Corvallis camp was a decisive step along the path that would lead to camp abilities. It was only a matter of time. Usher-friendly volleyball. After saying goodbye to Perkins and all of my students and friends, I had moved to Corvallis to become a graduate assistant, which involved running programs on campus, working in local schools, and supervising the master students in their practicum sites. We all got additional practical experience by running a Friday night sports program for children with disabilities called IMPACT, starting a parent support program, conducting adult exercise classes, and visiting schools. I also helped run the recreation and sports programs of several deafblind retreats in Oregon and Washington, put on by the Oregon Deafblind Project and Washington Deafblind Project and Carol Brown Woolen. Some weekends were for individuals with deafblindness. Others were for individuals who were deafblind and had additional disabilities. Each program was held at Christian retreat centers with beach areas and lots of grass. I set up baseball, soccer, hockey, parachute, swimming, and other fun games in which every person could participate. To play hockey, for example, we used frisbees with bells attached to the underside. We also played games like horseshoes, bocce, and disc golf. When we played volleyball, we used a beach ball. Participants would catch the ball, bounce it, and then walk up to the net and throw it over. When serving, they could move closer to the net. The support staff could catch the ball and hand it to the player if necessary. All athletes had support service providers, SSPs, who helped them know the position of the ball and provide direction when necessary. Communication was constant and clear, and all players felt included and totally safe. The participants renamed the game Usher-Friendly Volleyball. Usher syndrome causes adult-onset deafblindness. It sometimes occurs earlier. So simply by renaming the game, they were declaring how accessible the game was for people who are deafblind. The name caught on. For years afterward, every time I went to the American Association for the Deafblind, AADB, conference, or to one of these retreats, everyone wanted to play Usher-Friendly Volleyball. The idea was so simple, but to our knowledge, it had never been done before. Seebeck. A particularly valuable beachside retreat I encountered while living in the Pacific Northwest took place at Seebeck, west of Seattle, on the Kitsap Peninsula. Supported by Seattle's Lighthouse for the Blind, the week-long Seebeck Deafblind Retreat has attracted participants who are deafblind from all over the country since the late 1970s. It is a breath of fresh air for people who are deafblind and accustomed to feeling left out by not being aware of what's going on around them. It is a complete signing environment, meaning that every volunteer, deaf or not, signs fluently. And at Seebeck, every activity is accessible for participants who are deafblind. One year I was at Seebeck, Heidi Zimmer, a deaf mountain climber, came to speak. Heidi was 5'11", thin, muscular, and true to her Scandinavian roots, blonde with blue eyes. Though now she was losing her vision because of Usher syndrome, she had already climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, Denali, and Mount Everest. She brought her climbing gear so participants could feel the thickness of her down jacket, the pointy spikes on her crampons, her large backpack, the lightweight of her freeze-dried meals, and her heavy, life-saving ice axe. Her audience may have heard of mountain climbing, but until they could feel the equipment, they could not understand the concept of high-altitude climbing. Explaining how each piece of equipment worked took a lot of time, but the resulting clarity on the participants' faces was worth every minute. There were many aha moments when someone would nod and say, "Wow!" That summer, Heidi brought the sport of rock climbing to Seebeck, giving many participants an empowering experience. Outdoors magazine awarded Heidi recognition in its defining moments section. Seattle, near Seebeck, is the American city with the largest number of residents who are deafblind. Because people with Usher syndrome are sensitive to glare, the cloudy weather in Seattle is a definite attraction. Another is that the subway system is clean and accessible and runs on time. In addition, the Seattle Lighthouse for the Blind employs many people who are deafblind. Interpreter programs in Seattle always include instruction on interpreting for people who are deafblind. As a result, Seattle has a distinct deafblind culture with a variety of recreational activities and opportunities. Another location where the incidence of deafblindness is high is Louisiana, possibly because Usher syndrome is hereditary. In the past 30 years, many of those people have moved from Louisiana to Seattle. One year, a man named Floyd, who lived in Louisiana, attended the Seebeck retreat. Floyd had been the president of the Louisiana Deafblind Association, and his lifelong dream had been to attend the Seebeck Deafblind Retreat near where so many of his friends had moved. Because Floyd had ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, for many years, his medical complications had prevented him from going. When he arrived at the retreat, his wife, who is deaf, was at his side. He was using an electric wheelchair and oxygen, and he had a tracheotomy. But he was instantly in his glory when his old friends ran to him, hugged him, and greeted him with tactile sign. Every time I saw him during the next few days, he had a huge smile on his face. Floyd went to a few lectures and sat with friends at meals, yet he was having trouble breathing. His wife had to suction his trach tube every half hour, and those of us who could hear were aware of the constant suctioning when he was in the room. Wednesday night, there was an announcement that Floyd had been taken to the hospital. He died in the middle of retreat week. his last memory, the joy of spending time with lifelong friends. He truly lived to experience this time with his dear friends. It was a moving example of the positive power of this retreat in the lives of people who are deafblind. The experience stayed with me. Working with deaf children. The time with Floyd and his friends at CBEC had drawn me closer to the deaf community, and I loved sign language. There were few children with visual impairments near Corvallis, Oregon, so when it came time for my dissertation, a logical choice was to work with deaf children. In the capital city of Salem, about 45 minutes away, was an elementary school where deaf children made up about 20% of the student body. For my research, I taught hearing peer tutors sign language and trained them to work with the deaf students by repeating the PE teacher's instructions, giving feedback, and offering encouragement and motivation. We measured physical activity levels before and after implementation of the program. In the end, in a statistically significant finding, activity levels for both the deaf students and their peer tutors increased. Working on a dissertation that was not just about gathering data, but also about helping the students and the school was most rewarding for me. I received my doctorate from Oregon State University in 1995. At the ceremony, my mother, who had gone back to school for her doctorate when she had four children under the age of 8, beamed proudly from the front row. She had been a terrific role model. Now I would gather my wealth of accumulated experience and bring them to Brockport, New York, where I had been offered an assistant professor position at the State University of New York, SUNY Brockport, in adapted physical education. I had gathered a lot of confidence during my time at Oregon State, but fears remained, ever present as well. Was I ready to teach future teachers of children with disabilities? Would they believe in me? Would I believe in me? What's your dream? Dr. Lieberman, I never met a person with a disability. I looked at my new student in astonishment. It took me a moment to take in his words. I could see him squirming a bit under my gaze. I turned to the rest of the students in my first undergraduate class in adapted physical education at Brockport. How many of you have ever worked with a person with a disability? I asked them. None of them raised their hands. How many of you have ever talked with a person with a disability? Crickets. How many of you have ever met a person with a disability? As I slowly emphasized my words, I could feel a lump forming in my throat. Two students answered that they had gone to school with someone with a disability, but they did not know the student's name since they had been in different classes. The reality was that in the mid-1990s, many K-12 schools had no students with disabilities in attendance. In New York, if they went to the same school, they were in a different part of the building called BOCES, the Board of Cooperative Education Services. I suddenly realized the learning curve would be huge and that my job was urgent. In just one semester of class, I had to teach these students how not only to understand and accept children with disabilities, but to interact with them and confidently include them in physical education. I had arrived at SUNY Brockport feeling a bit like an imposter. I was just 30 years old and had very little college teaching experience. I was scheduled to teach a slew of undergraduate and graduate courses such as Analysis of Teaching, a graduate class, Adapted Physical Education Methods, and Assessment. I had to teach the disability sport class for graduates and undergraduates and supervise 5 student teachers who happened to be 60 miles away in Buffalo. I felt totally out of my element and wasn't sure I belonged at such an academic institution. To make it even more difficult, I was closer in age to most of my students than to most of my professional peers. This dilemma presented itself the day I arrived at Brockport. I went to the student union to pick up my identification card, stood in line, and when it was my turn for the photo, they asked me what my student ID was. It took some convincing before they accepted that I was a faculty member. I had the same problem at the college library. Many graduate students who were older than I was became natural allies and remain dear friends to this day. But that first semester was lonely. I worked in my office a minimum of 10 hours a day, and every weekend. I could barely keep up with the constant planning for my courses, as well as grading tests and papers and being on committees. I would sit in my office and wait for footsteps down the hall, hoping that someone was coming to visit me. I wanted students to need me and seek me out. Very soon after the revelation in class that none of my students had met anyone with disabilities, I implemented the Friday morning swim and gym program in which each of my students was paired with a child with a disability from a neighboring school. I used a program started in 1968 by my Brockport colleague, Dr. Joseph P. Winnick. Dr. Winnick had started the first master's degree in adapted physical education in the United States. Also in 1968, edited numerous books and received millions of dollars in government grants to train future teachers in APE. He was the real deal, a true leader in our field. I had known about him since my freshman year in college, and now I was teaching with him. Under close supervision, my students taught children with cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, autism, learning and intellectual disabilities, and speech and language issues. There were no children with visual impairments in this practicum experience. In just 8 weeks, my students had to assess the children's abilities and teach them improvements in motor skills, fitness, and aquatics. The aha moments, the, "Dr. Lieberman, you'll never guess what my child did today," moments were many. These were pivotal experiences for me and for them. As we continued the program, several of our students each semester would move on into the adapted physical education concentration and choose to devote their careers to teaching children with disabilities. The swim and gym program is still our practicum today, a pillar in our physical education program. However, undergraduates now come in with more experience interacting with individuals with disabilities in their schools, thanks to recent developments in understanding and in integration. In that fall of 1995, I arrived at Brockport young enough to be eager, but old enough to know I needed help to realize my as yet unshaped dream. If you're lucky, the right person arrives in your life at just the right time and guides you forward. I was lucky, and Colleen Donaldson was that person. Petite, with red hair, and impeccably dressed every day, she was a person who could make things happen. As a director of the grant writing class I was attending, she asked me one of those "what's your dream" questions. What do you want to do that you cannot do without some grant funding? I immediately thought of my wish to give my students the practical experience they lacked teaching children with visual impairments. Colleen helped me write a grant proposal that resulted in a $13,000 grant from the Dorothea Haas Ross Foundation to start an educational sports camp for children who are blind or visually impaired. I had never secured a grant before, and now I had the support to make a dream come true. When I got a letter from the dean congratulating me, it bolstered my professorial confidence. I was on my way for sure. I wanted the new camp to have a positive name that suggested what the kids could do, not what they couldn't do, indicating a special place, emphasizing abilities instead of disabilities. I gave my dream a name, Camp Abilities.